I will begin my presentation with two apologies. The first one, that I will speak in English, a language, my native language, but one I think quite foreign here in Barcelona. My second apology goes to my unfortunate translators. I'm afraid I have inflicted upon them a text which is difficult even in English. So, I beg your patience. I'll begin. Alles vergänglich ist nur ein Gleichnis, says Goethe. All the ephemeral is only allegory. To speculate, to reflect, or to project, the word means both things. Whether it is to reminisce upon some state of affairs, to observe or to narrowly examine something, or to exercise a faculty of hypothetical reasoning, speculation involves the parsing of space, of time, identity, and difference. The disposition of bodies distributed according to the deictic variation, whose persistence and stabilization in space and time are anything but secure, very often acquires a supplement in the form of an intercessionary technology, such as writing, the photographic, the cinematic, the transmitted trace of bodies, places, things. This instrumentality of the body, its pluralization, its occlusion in media, is such an accomplished fact of our modernity that it often passes unnoticed, naturalized in the regimen of things and events, its strangeness caught, if at all, in a glance, a ghost of peripheral vision, a mere specter of mediation. We might ask, where does such spectrality begin? Inside. The primary motor cortex is a strip of neural tissue running ear to ear along the surface of the brain. It is the brain's action center. For more than 60 years, scientists have been aware of its role in the orchestration of most types of voluntary movement, initiating actions as diverse as walking up and down stairs to complicated hand-eye coordination in the welding of dining utensils. Recent studies have shown that the primary motor cortex also has an introspective side, having to do with bodily perception and movement. Areas of the motor cortex become increasingly active, for example, during the experimental induced illusion in which people mistakenly perceive that a stationary part of their body is moving. While scientists have traditionally attributed one's sense of bodily position to the somatosensory tissue located adjacent to the primary motor cortex, it now seems that it is the primary motor cortex itself that not only issues commands, but also participates in the analysis of sensory information coming back from muscles. Using functional magnetic resonance imaging scans, researchers have found that the illusory perception of movement was accompanied by an elevation of blood flow in the primary motor cortex, a definite marker of heightened brain cell activity. Another current study using the same technologies reports that parts of that motor cortex also respond vigorously when test subjects do little more than silently read words. The relation between brain structure and exterior technical practice is all the more remarkable in that it is not just any written word that produces such an excitement, but precisely active verbs. My apologies, I will slow down. So the point is that when we pick up a book, a paper, a magazine, and read words that have to do with actions, walking, grasping, holding, words that have to do with the tongue, it activates the very same areas in our motor cortex that activate those limbs and those parts of the body. So a very curious interaction between the technology, writing and reading, and the body itself as it moves or perceives or anticipates its movement. The relation between brain structure and exterior technical practice is all the more remarkable in that it is not just any written words that produce this excitation, but precisely active verbs. As subjects read a verb referring to the action of a face, an arm, or a leg, those areas that control the specified action exhibit high rates of blood flow, a sign of intense neural activity. At the very same time that prominent activity occurred in these so-called pre-motor brain regions, there was also action in the two left brain structures, Broca's area and Wernicke's area, that have been linked to the understanding of language. The comprehension of active verbs linked to actions, coordinated by specific areas of the premotor and primary motor cortex, produce a ghostly excitation in those relevant areas. They trigger the same forms of excitation that occur when the brain moves its own feet. One cannot help but be tempted to speculate about the reaction of the brain in its interaction with other visual representing technologies such as photography, cinema, and video transmissions. Cinema, for example, secures our attention in just such a strange and familiar manner. We have an abiding fascination with visual experience. The act of looking is reflexive. The gaze, recognized and sustained, is folded back into itself as pleasure. We have an interest in novelty, in the revelations of desire, in sexuality and death, in scenes of violence, aggression, and the exotic. We have a peculiar curiositas in the very phenomenon of motion, duration, color, and form. Disregarding the synthetic origin of the persistence and retention of traces that produce the illusion of motion, we invest ourselves in the claims of the cinematic. Our cognitive involvement in its technical topoi forms a complex and enduring pattern of relations, relations between perception, reference, medium, and memory. The body is thus inscribed into a register of instruments engaged in prosthetic perceptions which are indistinguishable from and a supplement to its own sensations. Such inscriptions, of course, have a history, and there are technical substrates of unconscious memory that persist and permeate our relations to those very instruments we devise, writing us into the writing of light and movement, shaping, delimiting our forms of attention and the modes of address which, in their interaction with this machinery, recognize the specular as intimately linked with the real. In 1927, Ivan Pavlov described a reflexive orienting response of human test subjects to novelty in their perceptual environment. Whenever something occurs that is new or unusual to an organism, the individual stops, turns its senses to the source of the stimulation. This tacit sensitivity to movement is a part of our evolutionary heritage, doubtless having conferred an advantage in response to predatory threats. Typical physiological effects are the dilation of blood vessels to the brain, a slowing of the heart, a consequent constriction of blood vessels to major muscle groups. There is a drop in skin resistance, and alpha waves are blocked for a few seconds before returning to baseline level as the brain focuses attention on the stimulus. This behavioral arrestment occurs, for example, with sudden noises or shifts in the relative luminosity of objects. In 1986, researchers at Stanford University and the University of Missouri began a study to determine whether the simple formal features of television, cuts, edits, zooms, pans, sudden noises, would activate the orienting response and therefore keep involuntary attention focused on the screen. Careful monitoring of the test subjects' brainwaves allowed them to conclude that these structuring devices in media can indeed trigger voluntary and involuntary orienting responses. When the formal issues and features in television are projected, action sequences, advertisements, or music videos, it was found that they come at a rate of approximately 1 per second and thus constantly activate the orienting response. Moreover, when certain regular sensory stimuli, luminance, tone, or rhythm, for example, are stopped or omitted, and therefore change the anticipated pattern, the orienting response also engages. It is not surprising that cinematic strategies of sound image composition, editing, and mise-en-scene also operate in this register. The human visual system, recognizing a change in luminosity as a change in form, gives unconscious credence to our investment in the fidelity of cinema's flickering sensibilia. We presume the deferred presence of somebody as having been, at some time, present, before the camera, such that it, the device, unintentionally, or someone else behind the camera, intentionally, has observed and faithfully secured the image of the person or event represented. But, as Benjamin reminds us, the camera itself does not see. It has been prosthetically inserted between the original subject and the intending eye of the person operating the camera, so that it circumscribes and subsumes that space, a camera eye which holds place for, simulates, the presence of the eye of the spectator, such that there is a presumed coextension and identification between the apparatus, the spectator, the original one, and the present spectator. This presumption organizes perceptible phenomena to serve as evidence, a trace of photographic verisimilitude, a technically reproducible access to the real. It is an instance of the camera's penetration into human recognition, as happens when we look at a photograph of some person or watch an actor, a character in a movie. As the film unfolds before us, there are moments of sympathy or dislike, times when our heart may race, our breathing becomes shallow, hair stands on end, and we become aroused or terrified or burst into laughter almost before we know it, as if those shadows before us have a privileged link to the present that has not passed away, but which once, having taken place, arrested in the trace of an image, is present at every moment and persists, holding place for the potential recuperation. Cinema is promissory. There is a strange anticipation concerning technical reproducibility in its very social configuration, a presumption that the repetition of the real constitutes a privileged access to the original act or event, a strange, modern, spatial conceit that locates the deferred, absent trace in some recoverable elsewhere. Still, while the figures on the screen may indeed be insubstantial phantoms, easily distinguished from corporeal reality, the experience of motion in the cinema, at a physiological level, cannot be distinguished from the experience of real motion. As Christian Metz notes, there is a perceptual basis for the assertion that motion is not representation, but presentation, not a re-experience, but an original experience of motion, since the very same mechanisms that process real motion and apparent motion are brought into play in both cases. Those very same mechanisms for discerning the real enable our investment in a play of shadows, and there is an uncanny commutability between one register, the physiological, and another, the phantasmatic, such that there is a real engagement in the illusion of the specular. In 1896, the film Démolition d'une mur by Auguste Louis Lumière begins with three figures standing in front of two perpendicular walls, structures that must have, at some time, been the walls of a house. One of the walls extends from the foreground, left, into the background, and the other connects with it in the background and extends from there into the right side of the screen. One man, whom we take to be the foreman, sends the other two off frame, one man to the right and the other to the left. The foreman remains in the center of the frame while the other two disappear. After a moment, one of the men reappears in the small space between the wall and the left terminal edge of the frame. Seconds later, the left wall collapses, and the two men rush to the pile of stones remaining near the center of the frame. As the dust clears, we begin to see, in perspective, the space that the wall had masked. There are two salient points here. The scene is composed in such a way that the two walls create a cubic space within a projected frame so that the left wall is coextensive with the image, with the frame of the image, an attribution underscored by the reappearance of the man from off-screen just behind the wall. His appearance serves to demonstrate the structural similarity between two aspects of frame and wall, a contiguity of real and imagined spatiality, since both subject him to similar sorts of appearance and disappearance. The tumbling wall is a spectacle based entirely on the effect of movement upon the conventions of traditional perspective, and the cinematic frame is here revealed, configured, as an omnipresent mask or window over a coherent physical space. The production of a consistent and logical off-screen space is an effect of the presumption of contiguity connecting spaces of appearance and disappearance, here brought about through the transit of bodies. Demolition d'une mer was a very popular film, and it was often projected over and over again, forward and backward, as the audience sat, transfixed, caught up in the play between mise en scène, the casting or putting of things into place, and mise en abîme, casting it into the abyss. That one state could constantly be transformed into the other and back suggests a dynamic and phantasmatic recuperation of time. Such technical reproducibility is not so much an empirical fact of modernity as a structural possibility within the film, so that Demolition d'une mer may the trace sorry, excuse me, so that in Demolition d'une mer the trace of history, even of such a local nature, is rendered only through an arrestment of the image, satisfied only by repetition, exceeding the limits of its representation. The event, after all, has passed away. It is not so much that Lumière's wall disappears, but that it threatens constantly to disappear, and that the threat is rhythmically reproduced over and over and over, forward and back, preserving itself through the cinematic arrestment as being always on the verge of disappearing. This is perhaps most true at the very moment that it reappears. It is, as Benjamin might have said, an arrestment that causes the appearance of the present as history, or, to put it more precisely, as a trace of the possibility of history. Possibility figured in the trace of the survival of history through arrestment and repetition of what has passed away. This is bound to our capacity to read such traces as traces. The now time, Jetzeit, of the image stands for, in place of, what has passed away, the absent event survived by its trace, the photochemical index of cinema's presumed verisimilitude. In 2003, something similar occurs in The Matrix Revolutions when Neo, Keanu Reeves, is trapped in an interstitial space, a relay point between the simulated realities of the Matrix and the Machine City, a place named Mobile Station. Impatient and a bit anxious at the prospect of being trapped for an indefinite period of time in this liminal transfer zone, Neo jumps down onto the tracks of the subway system in an attempt to sprint to freedom. The shot is frontally framed like a proscenium with a foregrounded secondary level, the tracks, where the primary action will take place. It is perhaps another unconscious reference to a compositional feature favored by Lumière. As Neo, using the superhuman speed of his stimulated body, disappears from the left margin of the screen, he simultaneously reappears on the right, skidding to a halt in the very same space that he has just left. Disappearance and subsequent reappearance are simultaneously real and represented, artifactual and factual. And, accepting the narrative conceit of the Matrix, irreal, that is, a simulation. Neo's disappearance and reappearance secure the stability of the space as identical, confirmed by the mobility of the camera and the impossibility of the doubling of the body in the given space. In other words, the insistence of the reality of this space as simulation is a necessary ground for the continuity of a singular body, even though its perceptible trace is pluralized. Neo is doubled from one side to the next. The impossibility of the doubled body is transferred to the impossibility of the sight, a curious interterritoriality between the cinematic body and architecture, the body as both trace and relay. Of course, such corporeal pluralities and interruptions are not at all foreign to cinema. Indeed, they are among its most common occurrences, taking place as edits, articulating narrative economies through the abbreviation of the body's disposition. In an early silent reel, Buster Keaton uses a simple matte technique to double his own body over and over and over again, causing himself to inhabit every position of every musician in an orchestra. It is an astonishing effect, both for its artifice and for its very contemporary-seeming realism. Keaton's body is inscribed into place after place after place, yet the effect produced by this pluralization of spatiality is exactly the collapse of every iteration into a single time. Much of the effectiveness of this scene is due to an enduring fascination with the spectacle of discontinuous motion. Keaton plays every instrument differently and simultaneously. This operates as a referential trace to the actual. In other words, The impossible doubling of the body in the photographic index is sutured to spectacle not only as a surplus, but as a supplementary structuring principle, its appearance laying claim to the real through repetition and occlusion of the same space. It is an impossibility, but a perceptible one. In Lumière's Repas de Bébé in 1895, it was not the relatively repetitive activity of feeding an infant that captured the attention of the audience, but the small matter of leaves rustling in the breeze in the background, moving discontinuously. A small matter indeed, but for an audience familiar with the closed circuit of mechanical illusions of motion via such devices as thaumatropes, zoetropes, phenakistoscopes, and other more exotic machines, the discontinuous demarcated the territory of the real and confirmed the verisimilitude ceded to the camera. Bodies such as Keaton's were both true and false, simultaneously inscribed into the present tense of the artifact and the future anterior of the mediated trace. Only time has been affected, and such temporal attenuations or dilations disappear into true duration. But what a curious distinction is made by the parsing of time as an artifact whose evidentiary trace is a body. Dominique François Arago, writing in the Photographic Times in 1887, after seeing an instantaneous photograph of a bird in flight, describes the result as blurred lines, if indeed there is any record at all, since the impression is not only a single instant that has been registered, but the impression of all succeeding instants, while the plate remains exposed. Here again, we have truth, in fact, but not apparent truth. Arago goes on to remark on the marvel of instantaneously photographing a bird on the wing, so perfect that every feather could be seen. There's a strange duplicity in this comment, a skepticism concerning the truth contained in the arrestment of a body, subtracting it from life, and at the same time, a fascination with the exactitude represented by the very trace of that arrested body, adding it to life. While the chronophotographic experiments of Etienne Jules Marais, Demenis, Audemars, Anschutz, and others sought to record the transformations of physical bodies in motion, their effect was to evacuate precisely the body they sought to fix, capturing in the static accretion of images something less a record of patterns of matter than a spectral image of rhythm and movement, rendering bodies transparent, ghostly, evocative. Shortly after Marais' Le Vol des Oiseaux of 1890, there appeared a certain number of exceedingly strange objects, cast, bronze, sculptural works derived from the chronophotography of birds. There's something quite strange and bizarre in a sculpture which represents successive phases of the motion of a bird in flight, and which does so by embedding each body into the next, so that there is an occlusion of what is, after all, the same bird occupying a different number of the same places at once. Again, time has disappeared, and the parsing of bodies has rendered it salient. We can also take up the problematic of coextensive iterations of the body and temporal dislocation in other more contemporary instances. The bodies in transit throughout the Matrix Reloaded are subject to all manner of distortion. In every fight scene, there is a complex visual and auditory choreography of bodies whose primary function is to define or constrain the contours of narrative space. At the point of initial contact, in the courtyard scene between Neo and the multiple replicating Agent Smith, for example, there is an increasingly resonant rhythm track, a frenetic trance techno glitch beat, which literally fills up the space between spectator and spectacle, teasing and engaging the audience, suturing attention into a collective simulation of dance. This acute attention to sound defines and establishes the intelligibility, variability, and frequency of the bodies that cross the screen, setting them into minutely composed patterns and intensities. Bodies vanish and appear, momentarily glimpsed, fragmented by frame or trajectory, or by the interruption of other bodies, arrested traces of the shape of time, employing rhythm to produce a synesthesia between auditory and visual intervals, a rhythm which both mirrors and embodies sound image configurations. Within this field, another pattern of rhythm simultaneously takes place. Extreme acceleration is represented by a near stasis. as bodies move from normal rate of speed to an increasingly slower space to a fixed and static arrestment. At this point, the camera which had thus far accompanied the body is suddenly cut loose to circulate and move freely in and around frozen figures. At the precise moment that the camera returns to a fixed relation to the body, the stasis collapses, and there is a very rapid acceleration followed by a return to the normal temporal pace of fighting. In other words, it sets up a rhythm. You have a normal pace, and as the body goes faster, like the slow motion that you have in sporting events or in the chronophotography of Edgerton, you move from normal to faster, meaning slower, slower, and slower, finally to the fixing static arrestment of the body, and then the speed increases rapidly and begins again, rapidly, again, rapidly. This therefore produces a rhythm that occurs in increments under 3 seconds, engaging, of course, our attention in an orating response. Every time we see this rhythm, participate in this rhythm over and over again, like a loud noise, we follow it, and our attention is secured. At the precise moment that the camera returns to its fixed relation to the body, the stasis collapses. There is a rapid acceleration followed by a return to the normal temporal pace of fighting. This configuration, a standing waveform, is repeated over and over again. Moreover, the moment where static image collapses into accelerated motion is always at the point of impact of a physical blow, such that the recipient of the blow, sometimes Neo, but most often Agent Smith, moves uncannily across the screen, engaging us in an unconscious reflex, a hardwired orientation of our perceptions to the unexpected novelty. The pace is rapid, the rhythmic patterning of visual-auditory collisions is quite effective. Where other films deploy bodies in a combination of wire work and digital post effects to construct an image, a tableau vivant, for example, Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, where special effects are used to compose an intricate, beautiful spectacle, in The Matrix, bodies are used as edits, temporal arrestments, dilations, and accelerations. These bodies in motion are impossible bodies, and the occlusion or penetration of one body by another, by the same, Smith, for example, yet the surplus index of plural bodies secures and legitimates the real effect of the visual field. Rhythm is used in a similar way in the rave in the cave scene in Zion after Morpheus' oration. Music starts, people begin to dance as the camera frames the distant, moving crowd, and then cuts to a close-up of Neo and Trinity, who take the opportunity to leave the chamber for a more private setting. The camera will continue to intercut between these two sites, the communal and the intimate. At the same time, the intensity of the music grows. Bodies becoming increasingly mobile and sensuous are framed in mid-shots and long shots, intercut with very close intimate shots of Trinity and Neo. Tension builds. The crowd becomes more energetic as the lovers themselves lose themselves in the rhythm. The entwined, dancing bodies become increasingly frenetic, their brief flashes of nudity, and the camera cuts back to Neo and Trinity just as they approach climax, completing a visual and rhythmic circuit where the erotic charge of the bodies in the chamber is transferred to the slow, almost static movements of the lovers. This metonymic relay effectively underscores the libidinal tensions of both collective and individual, so that when there is an abrupt eruption of a flashback, the memory trace of Trinity's impending fate, a premonition taking the place of orgasm, the silence is sudden and shocking. Bodies, repeated, attenuated, and deferred, operate as spatiotemporal markers, holding place, making space, representing their deferred presence as a prosthetic link to the real. But here, the boundaries and coherences of bodies begin to come undone. Not only is there a phenomenological sleight of hand before us, on screen, as well as within us, in the form of substrates of involuntary unconscious memory, but there's also a pronounced recursive recognition of this plurality. When Arnold Schwarzenegger was cast as the cyborg in James Cameron's The Terminator, 1986, The very fact of his own body was constructed in and by an agonistic relation with a regimen of machinery, the gymnasium, the Nautilus machines, weights, and the like. Such a construction is readily mapped onto the fictional construct of, I quote, an envelope of living human flesh formed around the contours of an interior chrome molybdenum armature. It was, in fact, Schwarzenegger's, the ideal body to represent a false body. Nonetheless, its reality secures the ground for the film's realism. In fact, a highly abstract hyperrealism, fissioning between different topoi cued for the spectator by different optical filters. Blue, signifying a transition to the future. Yellow, the most subtle, giving a warm Southern Californian glow to the altogether too neat, too pretty world invaded by the Terminator. And red, territorializing the cyborg's point of view. There's a very interesting occurrence in a scene where the cyborg, having been shot repeatedly, burned, knocked down, hit by cars through various wrecks, has taken a room in a cheap hotel. The envelope of living flesh has sustained a lot of damage, and it is beginning to smell somewhat rank. The camera cuts to an exterior view of a slovenly janitor pushing his cart down a dirty hallway. As he approaches the door to the cyborg's room, he pauses, sniffs the air, and then raps on the door.
And what do you got in there, a dead cat?
Cut to the interior of the room, then to a red filter, the cyborg's POV, where there is a complex navigational interface with an active cursor. A number of responses appear in English, and the cursor travels down the list, reading one to the next, cuts, selects one, cut to an exterior shot, you see the cyborg's face. He performs, "Fuck you, asshole." Cut to the exterior hallway. The janitor shrugs, continues on his way. End of shot. Here's the interesting question. Who reads? We do. Although that we remains a generalized and anonymous component of the cinematic machine, and no specific subject is required for all of the various forms of address that take place here. It is a remarkable moment as we, who momentarily occupy, take up residence in this space, find ourselves in the place of the machine. There's no small bit of irony here. It is a crucial moment, too, in the economy of the science fictional narrative, the moment of uncanny embodiment, where our familiarity as spectators is too familiar, where there is a surplus of familiarity, a moment of awe and horror. From that moment on, we are complicit with the monster's relentless proleptic pursuit, and its recurrent presence as a marker of time drawn out shapes all the rest of the film. Only a little bit more. How is your patience? Okay? A little more. Small details, perhaps, of a probabilistic spread of data fragments, flickering shadows of the movement of bodies, engaging senses in a cognitive construction of an artifact, the boundaries of which already permeate our own. Machines for seeing modify perception, as Virilio notes, but they do so invisibly. Cinema's complex intertwining of architecture and memory, technology, perception, unconscious habit, and bodily disposition is a lived technology whose prosthetic perceptions are naturalized as our own, and whose aura of objectivity underwrites our investment in its phantasmatic register. Inside the cinematic proscenium, we are linked to a specular machinery where behavior modifies and is in turn modified by instruments that interactively construct experience, so that our perception of the real is grounded by historically contingent memory, relations to specific forms of the specular, so that we respond as if the plain light and shadow were the future anterior traces of human presence. The body's engagement with other bodies persists as a common, inextricable component of the apparatus, and our familiar everyday perceptions are linked to a history of cinematic artifacts, so much so that even our recognition of their artifice, it's only a movie, is a culturally mediated form, a naturalization of the phantasmatic nature of such technologies, rendering them all but invisible. What we had thought were sensations have become ghosts, transfixed in a flash, mere after images, an aspect of the naturalization of cinema. We are haunted by such images, such trailings of an elsewhere that we have made our own, domesticated fragments that we have compelled to enter into familiar relations, uncanny economies of sense, presence deferred to an impossible proximity, but never lost entirely. These patterns of deferred presence based on a referential surplus value of indexicality underscore the effect of the real produced by classical continuity editing. In certain cases, it is no more complex than the stabilized continuities which are conferred to a body through a plurality of voices under the sign of a proper name that, as a body passes on screen from one place to the next, every other body that it encounters pronounces a name. Keanu Reeves, John Wayne, Brad Pitt, Marlene Dietrich, fill in the name. Those pronunciations, those responses constitute a continuity of that passage. There are, however, certain exceptions. In Leslie Thornton's Peggy and Fred in Hell, two small children appear, vanish, and reappear throughout a twisted, presumably post-apocalyptic topography. They are discontinuous transforms, bodies which leap forward in time. They age, while staying in the same places. They sometimes grow younger, sometimes older, sometimes staying the same in no discernible pattern. There's no one else. Theirs is an empty, vacuous world, save for all the noise and debris, the detritus of language, of narrative, of media, covering every surface. In this maelstrom of signs, Peggy and Fred operate like small, random, imperfect recording devices, mimicking or performing snippets of a culture no longer their own. Television is a primary site, and their recursive logic is to demarcate, by their strange presence, a dissolution of the real. Thornton's adaptive and proleptic series of interlinked episodes is one of the most extreme attempts at tracing the contours of cinematic incompletability. It is, in a sense, a kind of perpetuum mobile, a self-organizing generative machine. The story is minimal, aesthetic. Something has happened. Two children survive and are observed traversing a ruined terrain, interacting with the traces of technology, the detritus of sense. Television, always on, at least somewhere. Peggy and Fred mimic and cajole, embody and enunciate traces of the world, not theirs, but ours. Seen through their eyes, and one might ask, is their pretense directed or improvised, their reaction spontaneous or studied? Nonetheless, strange and uncanny. Like when they pretend to be adults. Their only guide is media. They can have had no possible experience of adulthood, and so they produce a profoundly distorted map of human being, an imposture which is both extra and intra-cinematic. Other things happen, interruptions, edits, transmissions, more recursions. The relationships between society, identity, technology, and subjectivity that underpin media culture no longer pertain here, although they persist as enduring shadows. Form and convention are equally under duress. There's a palpable sense of interactivity as narrative collapses under the strain of excess labor necessary for its preservation. Regardless, we are swept along and a new order of recognition begins to operate. Thornton tampers at a fundamental level with media's structures, its spatio-temporal configurations of duration, extent, effect, and causality. Peggy and Fred in Hell may be one of the most sustainedly proleptic works ever conceived, a hypnotic and consuming anti-narrative about narrative. In Have a Nice Day, Alone, another intermediate section of Peggy and Fred in Hell, the entire spatial field of the film is activated by a technological nervous twitch, a beautiful hypnotic pulsing of the surface. The image shrinks, flows, collapses, seems to follow some strange hidden agenda. Intermittently, there is a text about speech on screen, visible through the pulse. In the background, extreme forms of vocalization, yodeling and macabre laughter, punctuate the visible space. As the image flutters, a robotic voice speaks about the various conditions of speech, silence, rhythm. Language is dislocated as one finds oneself, sub-vocalizing the texts that appear on screen, sometimes before, sometimes slightly later than the voiceover. It is unclear whether the voice mimics or generates the text as it becomes more energetic. Finally, a small child, Fred, emerges and calms down the mechanomorphic entity. The mode of address shifts from the position of a voiceover to that of a subject or character within the film as the child interrogates the voice. No longer authoritative and exterior, the voice is engaged within the mise-en-scene, interacting with the child, and then withdraws into an almost reflective repose, talking to itself. It is once again a palpable experience of an artificial intelligence, one which is both complicit with us and utterly alien. Thornton's works, by reproblematizing the screen where such strange cartographies take place, do their part to deconstruct the media image of the world, not to show you where the world really is, but to reveal that, at least, it is not at all where you think it is. Quentin Tarantino introduces a similarly anxious series of heterotopic cells in Kill Bill Part 1. For Thornton, the body is a transmission, subject to all of the infelicities, accretions, and dispersals of transport. For Tarantino, the body is an armature of light, in essence, an architecture. These dispositions are not so different. Both accept with good grace the presumptions of media, the conventions and stereotypes, and requisite deep, reactive levels. In Kill Bill Part 1, the choreography of multiple bodies is arrested, slowed down, and suspended, stabilized to produce an extreme artifice, an architecture of blood as spectacle. The camera body, generalized and thematized, is cut loose. It does something quite unexpected and novel to the complicated attribution of assimilated bodily presence that we take as our own. Suddenly, we too are elsewhere, as Uma Thurman's body slowly pinwheels over the surface of her opponent's, an overhead shot. The camera disengages to move away in a symmetrically opposite spiral, leaving but the merest moment where maxima and minima of the respective trajectories are coextensive, fixing her body, silent, perfect, for a fraction of a second. Time and space come undone. For Thornton, the resulting space is hellishly infinite, displaced from increasingly precise measurements of time and space into immeasurable excesses of an instant without duration and without dimension. For Tarantino, the body may be a quaint conceit, an enabling construct in an endlessly seductive agony in the preservation and violation of forms. The body is once again recognized as phantasmatic, not the faint ghost and shadow that we have suspected, but something far more strange and far more contemporary, a phantasm coupled with architecture. Spider-Man's body is not so much a superpowered being as it is an architectural effect, an afterimage of the city. Or transmission. Such a species has included Tron, The Matrix, Avalon, Tetsuo the Iron Man, Existence, and many, many others. A transmission whose presence within absence has yet to play out in media, the supplementary field of the world. I thank you very much for your patience.
Leslie va introduire son travail, comme Tom l'a déjà fait, mais Leslie va introduire son travail. On montrera un extrait du film, mais si vous voulez le voir entièrement, il faudra revenir dimanche après-midi.
Okay, we're going to just look at about 15 minutes of this project, this serial project, Peggy and Fred in Hell tonight. I thought I should give a little bit of a background. This is a project that I've worked on for 20 years, almost 20 years now. The first episode was completed in 1984. When I started this work, what I was thinking about, the big theme for me was a changing relationship between the scale of technology and the human body, the scale of the body. And I originally had planned the film with two adults whose names actually were Peggy and Fred. who were kind of an eccentric couple. But then I met these children that you'll soon see, and they took over. They were enchanting and took over the project. I worked with them off and on for about 8 years, shooting material in a couple of sets. We turned our house into a set. They were my neighbors. And we would meet in different places once a year after I moved away from San Francisco. I should tell you that the first... let me backtrack. When I started working with the children, what became more important was the children entering the kind of machine of culture. So originally, the focus on technology, I'll explain a little more, but there was a shift towards an idea of culture as a machine or a technology, and a witnessing of these children adapting. I did have a narrative conceit, which Tom mentioned, but it was just briefly that these kids were in a post-apocalyptic world, that they may be the sole living beings, that because they're the only people around, they can have everything and they can go every place. So they move from house to house. And I think of them as feral children or wild children who were raised by TV, which is actually pretty close to the way they were raised. They grew up without a mother and they were alone a lot. And they did mimic television and films. They were kind of obsessed. So you'll see just for two episodes. The very first episode is one that I made recently. And it involves footage, archival footage, in which my father appears. He's identified as Dad. And I made this piece after September 11th, 2001, and the last two episodes of the whole series, if you do see it on Sunday, were also made as readings of the post 9/11 ambiance. Let's say. So the whole project began because I was maybe especially focused on anxieties surrounding Cold War and defense and war in general, because I did, my father and my grandfather both worked on the atom bomb in somewhat key positions. So, and I grew up in the 50s, and in America, you know, if everyone had, or in my neighborhood, we all had fallout shelters and big cans of salty crackers and rusty water in the basement. And I was thinking about this work that my family, the men had been involved in trying to reconcile the kind of work they did with the people I knew and loved, that led to thinking about this theme of the scale of the technical exceeding the scale of the human. So that's where the project begins. And I finally worked with this material, these images of my father after 9/11, because it's too complicated to say, really, but there were echoes and inversions, and I should also say about Peggy and Fred in general that when I started the film and until 2001, I thought of it as science fiction-like. I thought of it as set, being set in some kind of future, a familiar environment, but in the future. And then after 9/11, I realized, no, it's not a future now, it's a present. And currently, it's become a past. So I don't know how long it'll stay in the past. It's a project that I will probably always work on. I think in the advertising material for this program, it mentions that I use archival material. I should say that in shooting footage with these kids for 8 years, in a sense, I was creating an archive of material of them. So I do approach the material I shot myself as an archive. I dig into it for different reasons at different times. The project's never really finished, and the archival, the idea of the archival is very blurred here. I do have archival in the traditional sense, material mixed in with stuff I've shot, and I also imitate found forms. So in working with past, present, and future, I do try to blur all of those lines. I guess that's enough. Okay, so you'll see the prelude and Peggy and Fred in Kansas.